We are speaking today with James Howard Kunstler. He is author of the new book, The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. James, thanks for speaking with us today.
Nice to be here, Mike.
If you could begin with telling us, what was your motivation in writing your book, The Long Emergency?
Well, I'd written three previous books about suburbia and the fiasco of post-war American land development, and all of those sort of led me in the direction of having to reflect on what would happen if we weren't living in a society that had such access to such cheap energy, and cheap oil in particular. You know, when you're reflecting on a car-dependent society. And that's pretty much what led me to this, apart from signals that were coming from, you know, many of my colleagues and people around the world, that we were really heading into a serious problem with oil. And that, in fact, it's more or less here.
So had you been familiar with the concept of peak oil for a while?
Yeah, I'd say since the mid-1990s when Colin Campbell, the British former chief geologist for major oil companies, published his first book on the subject. And all of a sudden, the topic started to sort of filter around. And it's picked up a lot of traction as the problem itself has presented itself. And now I think the signals from the oil markets are indicating that something is up.
Can you tell people that aren't familiar with it what exactly peak oil is?
Well, it's the idea that sooner or later we will reach a global oil production peak, a point at which the world will never produce more oil, and after which the supply will decline steadily and remorselessly. And it will change everything about how we live. And that's what it's about.
So if we still have basically half our known supply of oil left at that point in time, what's the real problem here?
Well, that's a good point. And something that is uniformly misunderstood about this problem. We don't have to run out of oil to really get into trouble. All we have to do is begin our trip down the slippery slope of declining supply. And what will happen is that the complex systems that we depend on for our everyday life are going to start wobbling and destabilizing. Things like industrial agriculture as it is now practiced in the United States. You know, the idea that we pour all this oil on the soil and we use all this natural gas fertilizer, and the result is a lot of cheese doodles and Pepsi-Cola. And, you know, we have a kind of a commercial food industry where, you know, most of the things on our table have traveled 1,500 miles. That whole system is going to be challenged. The way we do commerce and trade, you know, with Walmart getting its 12,000-mile pipeline of household goods from China, that's going to be a problem. Where we live is going to be a problem. The fact that people depend on these long commutes and that, you know, they're spending 3 hours a day in their car both ways. You know, the way we do education, these gigantic centralized schools that depend on the fleets of yellow school buses, and all of this stuff is going to become a real problem for us.
Based on your studies, when do you believe we're going to reach the point of peak oil?
Well, I think we're in the zone and that the markets are already giving us an indication that something is up. The fact that the prices are so volatile that they, you know, they've gone over $50 a barrel, and, you know, they'll go up $5 in a week and come back $5 and go up again. You know, I think we're going to see a ratcheting effect with the prices. I think that the conflict in the Middle East that began a few years ago is but a preview of pretty long-term sustained conflict that we're going to see as the great nations of the world contest over the remaining oil supplies in the world, two-thirds of which are in the Middle East, and much of the rest of which is in Central Asia. These things are going to thunder through our economies. You know, something I left out from the first question that you asked was that there's a tremendous implication with peak oil for industrial economies that they will not continue to grow, since fossil fuels are the lifeblood of industrial economies. And with them not growing anymore, you start to get real problems with finance, for example. Finance is the idea that your wealth is accumulating and producing more wealth. and involves the, you know, paper instruments that signify that, the stocks and the bonds and so on. And, you know, if we have no real industrial growth, we will also have a problem with those financial instruments and everything they represent, and the expectation that people can get wealthy in any way. In fact, I'd say that the housing bubble is in its own way a signal that financial instruments are not producing enough income and wealth. So people are looking elsewhere for places for their capital to grow, and the housing bubble is a result of that, partly prompted by the agency of supernaturally cheap interest in mortgages. So there are all kinds of implications to this. Eventually, you know, you'll see people losing jobs, losing incomes, unable to keep up with their house payments, unable to keep up with their car payments, unable to afford the gas for the long commutes, and all sorts of cascading problems emanating from this.
And is the U.S. economy most intimately tied into the oil economy? I mean, I know, for instance, I've heard for years the terminology, the petrodollar.
Well, it's true that a lot of the trade in oil is denominated in dollars, and one of the side effects of this whole picture that I'm describing is that the dollar has lost value. It's just another one of those really financial paper instruments that is being challenged by the notion that industrial economies will not grow anymore. But looked at another way, I think all advanced economies are going to be in trouble, and the world is going to become a larger place again as globalism tends to wither in the face of this. The Europeans may, in some respects, be a little bit better off than we are, but, you know, only in certain respects. They didn't destroy their towns and their cities, and they didn't destroy their public transportation. Their railroad systems are still working pretty well, so that they're not entirely dependent on cars to get everything done. And they didn't destroy local agriculture. You know, they did in part, but not entirely the way we did, nor the activities associated with it, you know, the food processing activities. So, you know, in that sense, they may do a little bit better, at least in the beginning, but all industrial economies are going to be affected.
Talk about those sectors that are going to be hit hardest. You started out with public transportation. Could you talk about the problems with our current public transportation?
Well, we don't really have much. We have a railroad system that the Bulgarians would be ashamed of, and not much else on the local level. You know, our bus systems are generally understood to be for losers. You know, most middle-class people won't use them. And, you know, we've been enjoying the oil fiesta. But, you know, I would take this in a somewhat different direction by saying this. You know, where the economy is concerned, the dirty secret of the American economy is that it has mostly, for the last 20 years, been about the creation of ever more suburban sprawl and the furnishing of it and the accessorizing of it and the servicing of it. And if you subtract the suburban sprawl sector from our economy, you know, the home building industry and the car industry and all that, there's not a whole lot left besides hair cutting, fried chicken, and open heart surgery. And, you know, people ask, why don't our leaders tell us about these problems with energy that are going to soon come to a crisis? And you know, my answer is that they don't want to talk about the economy and about exactly what it is, because if they actually go there and tell us, you know, what our economy is truly about, then there won't be a whole lot left. If George Bush turned around tomorrow and said, well, you know, we can't keep on building suburban houses and we can't keep on having an economy based on the creation of ever more mortgages for suburban houses, that would take a lot of the steam out of the economy. They're desperately levitating it as it is. So that's really where that's at. And then there are, you know, a lot of corollary things that go with that, like the easy motoring tourist industry. You know, a lot of towns and cities in distress over the last 20 years have endeavored to save themselves by trying to create a tourist economy based on people driving around from other parts of the country. And that doesn't have really great prospects. So we're going to have to reinvent what we do in America. And we're, you know, the response is that we're probably going to have to downscale most of how we live, and we're probably going to have to live a lot more locally.
So talk about that some more, living more locally. What in a city like, let's say, Seattle, what would people be looking at?
The big cities of America are going to contract. It's going to be a painful process. They're not going to disappear. They occupy very important sites. You know, Seattle obviously occupies a wonderful harbor situation, and it's not going to go away, but they're going to contract. We're going to have problems with the megastructures and skyscrapers. They were designed for a cheap energy economy, and we're not going to be living in it. There are going to be fewer white-collar jobs. You know, I think that the more successful places in the United States are going to tend to be the smaller places, especially the places that are close to viable agriculture. The industrial food production system is going to break down. We're going to have to grow more food close to home, and that's going to have tremendous consequences and implications for how we live. Agriculture, I think, food production may come a lot closer to the center of American life than it has been for a long time. And we may have to do it differently. It may involve a lot more human labor. That could imply far different social relations than we've experienced in a long time. There may be a lot of resentment about it. People resenting having to work for the fortunate people who own the good land. We don't know how that's going to resolve. We don't know how we're going to reallocate land for food production. The subdividing habits of the last 50 years have been very destructive. The integral nature of the landscape has really been compromised, and there are far fewer opportunities to even create farms where there used to be because of the spread of suburban fabric. So that's going to be a problem. Suburbia itself is going to be a problem because it's going to lose value. It has to be thought of as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. You know, a place that really had no future, and that future is now here, and people have their wealth invested in suburban property, and it's not going to retain its value. So that's going to be a problem. And we're going to see, I think, a lot of turbulence, a lot of population movements, people leaving one part of the country, moving to other parts of the country. That's why I call this book The Long Emergency. I think that it's going to go on for a while. There's going to be a lot of turbulence in all areas of our life, social, economic, political. And we're in for quite a wild ride.
So do you see things like strip malls being eventually demolished and that land being reallocated towards farming?
Not generally. I think that the strip malls and the mega stores and the big boxes and all the parking lots are going to go through a period of abandonment for a long time. I don't think we're going to depave them. That itself would require a lot of energy that we may not even have. They're probably more likely to be the ruins of the future and the, you know, the salvage yards of the future.
So talk about alternative forms of energy. Why aren't they going to save us?
Well, there's certainly a lot of hope, a lot of wishful thinking, and a lot of reasonable hope that alternative fuels and systems for using them will rescue us from the global energy predicament. But the truth, I think, is that no combination of alternative fuels or systems for using them is going to allow us to run the United States the way we're used to running it, or even a substantial fraction of it. We're not going to run the interstate highway system in Disney World on biomass or hydrogen. The hydrogen economy, so-called, I think has been sold to the American people largely as a hoax. The hydrogen is a very difficult thing. First of all, it is the most common element in our neighborhood of the universe, but it's always associated with other elements and chemical compounds, and it takes more energy to separate the hydrogen than you get from the hydrogen that you've separated. And that's only one of many problems associated with hydrogen. There are others that have to do with the transportation and storage of it. Very, very difficult. So the idea that we're going to build a parallel infrastructure for hydrogen, you know, to replace our oil infrastructure is pretty unlikely. Not going to happen. I think much more likely that we will downscale and rescale the things we do. We're going to have to live closer to the places we work. We're going to have to find new vocations. You know, a lot of different job categories are going to vanish. There are going to be far fewer public relations executives and far fewer marketing directors and things like that. There are going to be far more agricultural workers. People will need to find professions and vocations that are very hands-on. You know, whether it's, paramedical professional or, you know, working with your hands in some way, creating real things. We're not going to relive the 20th century, and we're not going to reopen a lot of the factories that closed. Many of them are falling apart. Many of them in my part of the country, in the eastern U.S., are many of the old factories have been demolished. So we're going to have to find new ways of doing things. We're going to have to live locally. We're going to have to produce a lot of our household goods locally. So it's a tremendous transition, and it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be unattended by disorder and turbulence and possibly even violence. You know, one of the biggest things that we face is the fact that the long emergency I talk about will produce a lot of economic losers, people who have lost positions in the world that they will never regain, people who have lost incomes that they will never get back. These losers, who I call the formerly middle class, and there will be a lot of them, are going to be angry and full of grievances and resentment, and they'll be puzzled and bewildered about their loss of the entitlement to the American dream way of life. And they may express themselves politically, and that may lead to a lot of political mischief and extremism. It's happened before in human history, and I hope that that doesn't happen, but it's one of the possibilities.
Talk about solar and wind power. Why won't they help us?
Well, I think we are going to see some solar and wind power, but they will only supply really fairly small, I think fairly negligible amounts of electricity compared to what we're using now. And we may only use them on a very local, you know, neighborhood or even household basis. There are some other considerations with solar and wind power. One is that we don't even know whether we can manufacture the hardware for this stuff without an underlying oil economy. You know, the turbines, the solar arrays, the advanced metallurgy that's required to do this, and the complex manufacturing procedures. So that's a question in itself. Another question is, you know, solar electricity, it costs quite a bit for a home system. Even a modest home system costs about $8,000 to $10,000. And, you know, if you have one, will it be resented by the people who live around you, you know? There may be all sorts of new class issues associated with this, the people who have electricity versus the people who don't. And those are things we're not thinking about at all. You know, the same thing goes for wind turbines, by the way. You know, they require the same kind of advanced fabrication and metallurgy and production, etc.
And what about biomass?
There are a lot of hopes for biomass, and I think that, you know, obviously we'll be using some of them, but I think some of them are misplaced. A lot of the biomass people I talk to, you know, the people who want to do biodiesel and ethanol and stuff, don't seem to take into account that, for one thing, we will have to devote more cropland to human food production than we have now, because we're going to have to compensate for the loss of oil and gas, fertilizers and herbicides and stuff that we're using to keep our crop yields extraordinarily high. Our crop yields are going to be lower in the future. We'll need more cropland for human beings rather than less cropland that we can devote to biodiesel and biofuels. The biofuel enthusiasts are also not taking into account the fact that we may need to devote some of this land to feed animals, working animals. Now, I don't think everybody's going to be using working animals. Not every farmer is going to be using oxen and mules, but some of them will be. More of them than today, probably. And if so, you know, how much of that acreage is going to have to be devoted to growing animal feeds? Probably a not inconsiderable amount. So, you know, you start really looking at the problem a little more comprehensively. The solutions are not as magical as they appear.
All right. And what about coal? I've heard a lot from specific people that coal can come back.
Well, coal's already there. You know, we produce close to half of our electricity with coal, I believe. But there's probably less of it there than a lot of people believe. In fact, one of my buddies in town is a freelance writer who works for Rolling Stone and the New York Times Magazine and is writing a book about the coal industry for Houghton Mifflin on contract. And he's been talking to the coal executives for the last 2 years, and they tell him that there's actually considerably less coal than many Americans think there is, and that the quality is not as good as people believe. So, you know, we do not have a three-century supply of coal, as people believe. There's also the very big question that if we, you know, if we try to substitute coal for everything we're doing now, you know, running the interstate highway system and running Disney World, etc., that we would only succeed in pumping so much carbon into the atmosphere that we would accelerate greatly the climate change problems that are also a big challenge for us, and that are going to aggravate many of the problems that we have with energy.
And isn't quality one of the problems with the half of the oil that's left, that a lot of it's low quality?
Yeah, well, you know, we've been pumping oil for 150 years, roughly, and the oil that we got was the oil that was easiest to get and the highest quality. And the oil that remains tends to be the harder stuff to get and the lowest quality. You know, this stuff is categorized as either sweet crude, sweet light crude, or sour heavy crude. And the sour crude is a reference to the sulfur that it contains. If it's a high sulfur content crude, it's much more expensive to refine. And the heavy crudes are harder to refine than the light crudes, and so on. And, you know, there's also the problem that most of this remaining oil in the world is concentrated in the Middle East and in Central Asia, places that are harder for us to get to, places that belong to people who aren't that friendly to us, and places that will be contested by the other countries in the world that want oil.
And one of those is, of course, China, which has seen its demand for oil just skyrocket.
They have passed Japan as of 2004 as the second leading world consumer of oil.
And India isn't too far behind either, is that right?
Right. Although, you know, when we think about these two countries, India and China, a lot of people kind of attach this aura of invincibility to China as if, you know, they're the coming great power of the 21st century. You know, I'd have to add my two cents that China has ecological problems, population problems that make ours pale before them. Plus, they have a very unstable relationship between their leadership and their economy, and we have to think of them as the last great industrial economy that got ramped up, you know, not necessarily the coming world leader. They may have a lot of political and social problems just as much as we have, maybe even worse.
All right. One of the forms of energy we haven't touched on is nuclear. Do you see that as a possible solution?
I would reluctantly have to say, and I say as much in The Long Emergency, the book, that if we want to keep the lights on after a certain point, you know, maybe 2020, it's hard to specify. If we want to keep the lights on, we may have to use more nuclear power than we're using now. Nuclear power also will, you know, not be endless. And it obviously has very complex problems associated with it, and I wouldn't deny that at all, and we're going to probably have a national debate about it. But, you know, when push comes to shove, we may have to turn to it to keep the lights on. I think what the public sometimes doesn't understand is that, you know, these changes, first of all, these changes aren't going to happen overnight, but the period that attends these changes is going to be a fairly long period of turbulence and disorder where there's going to be a lot of stuff that's unsettled. We're going to be making this decision about nuclear over a period of years, and it's not going to be settled for a long time. This debate is going to go on, and, you know, then we'll make a decision, and then we'll see if we can make it work. There's also the possibility, as with solar and wind, that, you know, you can't really run a nuclear industry without having this underlying support of an oil economy. So that remains to be seen in its own right.
Also, talk about natural gas, since so many people are familiar with it, and it seems like there's an endless supply.
Well, the United States is arguably in more trouble with natural gas even than with oil, because you tend to get the natural gas that's on the continent that you're on, because it comes out of the ground at room temperature and is sent around the country by a pipeline network. If you have to get it from another continent, it has to be refrigerated and compressed, all at much greater expense, and then it has to be loaded on specially built refrigerated pressurized tankers and sent across the ocean to special terminals. And by the way, that trip across the ocean is problematical because natural gas tankers are fabulous targets for terrorists and international mischief, because when they blow up big. And nobody in America wants to have a new natural gas terminal next to them, you know, a place where the gas will be received from the tankers and regasified because they're dangerous. So already there have been several proposals to site new terminals, and the locals are, you know, there's a fierce NIMBY battle over them. We are already technically in depletion with natural gas. We're drilling as fast as we can to stay in place. And the prospect is that we're going to slip, and that the demand for natural gas is going to exceed the supply very, very soon. The price of it has already doubled since 2003, and it's likely to go much higher. Half the homes in America are heated with natural gas, and it's going to be a tremendous problem.
So why isn't the concept and the term peak oil more part of our current culture? I mean, if we're like watching the nightly news and constantly getting these reports on, you know, the price of a barrel of oil and how much people have to pay at the gas pump, why aren't Americans more savvy to this whole concept?
Well, because they've had poor leadership on it. There's really no leadership from the top down that's preparing them for this. In addition, I think that there are some sort of collective mental obstacles in the way. You know, there's a lot of wishful thinking about alternative fuels. There's a lot of wishful thinking that some hypothetical they are going to rescue us by, quote, coming up with technological wonders. Because our experience in the 20th century was that, you know, we had one technological achievement after the next, and therefore we conclude that this will just be another thing that we will overcome. It may not be the case. There's also the fact that, you know, this is a problem that can be described as an outside context problem. It is so far beyond the realm of normal experience for most people that they have a hard time accepting the reality of it. And so the result is a lot of collective static in our collective national imagination. We're also very, very distracted by all the infotainment and the, you know, the nonstop distractions of recreational shopping and easy motoring and the credit card fiesta. And we're just not paying attention to what's important right now. And it's very unfortunate. You know, life is tragic. History won't shed a tear for us if we fail to address these challenges. And other great civilizations have suffered by making similarly bad choices.
So you're painting a pretty bleak picture. Do you hold out any hope that...
Yes. You know, human beings are resilient. Human beings have a lot of ingenuity. They're resourceful. I think that there are a lot of benefits to us in going through and coming out of this thing if we can. We will be engaged in work that may be more meaningful for us, working with our neighbors, working shoulder to shoulder at things that are truly important to us, not frivolous. I think we'll regain a lot of social interaction and civic interaction that we've thrown away, that have partly been sacrificed to the diminishing returns of technology. Like, you know, the fact that, yeah, we have all these wonderful TV sets and all this canned entertainment and all these wonderful Sony music devices and iPods and things, they've only served to create greater isolation for individuals in our culture. And we have a very advanced technological culture and a high standard of living, and we probably have more anxiety and depression than any other society that's ever existed. So I think we stand to benefit from the readjustments that we're going to have to make in the face of the long emergency. And, you know, we've historically also been a brave, honest, and generous people in America. We've become rather lazy and sloppy over the last 20 years. But I think that we can get those virtues back, those qualities back, and use them to support the continuation of American civilization.
Well, James Howard Kunstler, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Well, Mike, it's been a pleasure, and I certainly wish you well in your corner of the country. And, you know, we're going to need good luck, and I hope you guys have it.